Welcome to a discussion with Christine Rose, professional genealogist, a certified lecturer, a fellow of the American Society of Genealogists, a co-author of the book titled The Complete Idiot's Guide to Genealogy, an author of numerous other books and articles on various principles and best practices of genealogical research, one of which is the focus of our discussion here. It's entitled Genealogical Proof Standard, Building a Solid Case. Christine, thank you for helping us to better understand the role and the importance of a standard of genealogical proof. So I know that there are five principal points to keep in mind, but perhaps you could address them one at a time. So to start off with, what, in simple terms, is the genealogical proof standard?
Well, Jim, first of all, we have, as you said, the five points. The very first one is that we conduct a reasonably exhaustive search. So, of course, what comes up here is, well, what do we mean by reasonably exhaustive search? That's probably our number one question. And what we don't mean is that you use 100 census records, 50 deeds, and you've done an exhaustive search. What we mean is that you extend the search to a variety of documents, and you think of anything, obituaries, death records, census records, military, federal land records, anything that might reveal something on that particular problem. So that's what we mean by reasonably exhaustive search. We extend that search.
Thank you. That was a helpful clarification. So what do we need to remember to do in the second point?
Our second point is that we collect and include in our compilation a complete, accurate citation to the source or sources of each item of information we use.
This is another point that I imagine people want clarification. That is to know what a complete and accurate citation consists of.
Now, we get a lot of questions about this one, Jim. Is it important, as far as a citation, that it be in a particular format? Well, there are standard formats. Basically, we use the Chicago Manual of Style for questions of style, and we use Elizabeth Schoen Mills' book on Evidence Explained, or her previous one on evidence, to cite sources that genealogists use. They are the best sources for actually presenting it. But basically, what you need to have in the citation is enough information that people can assess two qualities. One is that they need to know where the record is located, where you got the information, so that they can go and look at it if they want to. That's the number one reason for having the citation. But there's a second very important reason, and that is they have no way of judging the weight of that information if they don't know where it came from.
Thank you for that clarification. So what do we need to know about the third point?
On the third point, we analyze and correlate the collected information to assess its quality as evidence.
So tell us a little more about assessing the quality of the information that we collect.
Well, now, the key word here is evidence. What is evidence? Not everything that we collect is evidence. It's just information. Now we need to decide what our question is. You know, our research is broken up into a lot of little questions, actually. It's not one main question. It's little questions. What was the birth? When was the death? Who did this person marry? When did this person die? They're all parts of this. And only those items of information that bear on that particular question is evidence for that. If it's a birth, then anything that might reveal anything about that birth. If it's a death, again, anything that might reveal. That is probably one of our biggest problems, is misuse and misunderstanding of just what evidence is. Not all information is evidence.
So help us with what comes next.
Then we have point number four. We resolve any conflicts caused by items of information that contradict each other or are contrary to a proposed or hypothetical solution to the question.
So tell us a little more about resolving any conflicts caused by items of evidence.
Well, what do we mean there? We resolve any conflicts. Well, let's say that I am absolutely certain that John is the father of William. Everything seems to fit. The ages seem to fit, their locations. The family believes that John is the father of William, and everything seems to fit. But I find in the family Bible that there is an entry for another person of the surname whose first name was George, and he could fit as the father. So then, instead of my first inclination of sweeping that under the rug so I don't have to deal with it, then I have to do research on George. And I have to say, well, okay, he's a possibility and I can't overlook him. So then I do research on him. Maybe after doing some research using all these same steps, I find that he was an uncle, that he was not the father, but he was an uncle. So now I've resolved that. I've resolved what could have been a conflict. Now I can go back to my genealogical proof standard and say, well, I have resolved what that is.
So on resolving the conflict, I can hear some of our listeners right now asking the question, am I to understand that I should be gathering information from at least two or more sources for each event?
Absolutely, Jim. More than two or more. The more is the key word there. For each of these questions that we have to do an exhaustive search. Each of the questions.
So that kind of brings us back full circle to the first point of conducting a reasonably exhaustive search. We gather the information and then determine the nature of the evidence that may be discovered in the information source.
You've got it. That's absolutely right.
So talk to us about the fifth and the final point of this genealogical proof standard.
The fifth point of the genealogical proof standard is one that most people find easy to overlook, and that is that we arrive at a soundly reasoned, coherently written conclusion.
So why is this such an important point for us to keep in mind?
This is so important because especially when there's a conflict, it's important at any time, but especially if there's a conflict. Well, maybe in that case of the Bible and finding that George was the uncle, now I know in my mind that who he is, but unless I have it in my compilation, then other people don't know that I researched him and I determined who he was. And they're going to say, oh, well, she didn't realize that the Bible gave this person, maybe he's the father. Whereas if I include that into my compilation, there was a George that looked as if he was a likely prospect, but after doing research and looking at this and this and this and this and weighing all the evidence, I have determined that he was an uncle, then everybody else will know that I was aware of that. And that was resolved. So the written conclusion is really very important.
Can you explain a little bit about what and how much needs to be written into the conclusion?
Sometimes we have people that will wonder, well, you know, how do I bring in that written conclusion? Well, it can be just a paragraph in your compilation, in the section of your compilation that has to do with that particular individual. Sometimes when there's been some serious conflicts, people have written pages just on how they resolve that particular conflict.
Does a conclusion need to be written about each piece of information that is gathered relative to each event?
No, that too is an excellent question, Jim. No, you don't have to do that with every, like, this is a birth, now I'm going to have to write a summary of, you know, proof summary. No, but let us say that you have a compilation and I've written about this particular individual. Then in the section of that individual, let's say it was one of the children, then in his section, I would bring in my proofs or my discussion there of the information that was examined and any conflicts that were resolved. So that could be done with each individual, not with each item involving that individual.
There certainly is a lot to keep in mind on the way to proving relationships and events or any aspect of identifying your ancestors. So if it's not already apparent to our listeners, perhaps you could speak to the point of who are the ones that benefit from following the principles and best practices that you have outlined in the genealogical proof standard.
Well, I think everybody wins because I am constantly using the compilations of people that wrote family histories back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, many, many years before all of these standards were implemented by the genealogical field. And it's so frustrating to read this information that has absolutely no sources, you have no idea of how they came to their conclusions, what information they used to come to their conclusion. And so it's a case where you really have to almost start over with what the clues that they have provided and research these people again. Whereas if in our own compilations, we follow some standards, let people know where our information came from, we've written our conclusions, then they have a good foundation to start from. They may find we were wrong. They may come up with new information, and that's fine, but they know where your information came from, and they've got a good, solid base from which to start.
So let's talk about the concept of evidence for a moment. How does one go about the process of evaluating evidence?
We evaluate our evidence. And to do that, we, number one, use the source, whether the source is original or derivative. Number two would be information, whether that information is primary or secondary. And number three, evidence, if the evidence is direct or indirect.
So you've mentioned several concepts related to the source, the information within the source, and the evidence contained within the information. Can you take a moment and explain each of those?
The first one, the source, the original or derivative sources. Now, it's important to note that we say sources with this, original versus derivative sources. You know, we used to say copies instead of derivative. But copies doesn't fit everything. An abstract is not a copy. There's a number of types of records that aren't actually copies. But if we say a derivative, it's something that is derived from the original. So the original is the original source from which it came. A derivative came from that. So if I make an abstract of an original will, it's a derivative. If I make a photocopy, it was derived from the original. If I make a microprint, it is derived from the original. It doesn't mean that the derivatives are not good. Derivatives can be very good. Again, we have to put weight. A photocopy is a very high weight because hopefully the person's going to have properly photocopied it and it's going to be just as good as the original. On the other hand, if there's some problem, we notice along the way there's some problem, it could be somebody left a line off. They cut some names off the right-hand part of the page. In some cases, purposely altered it in the copy. So it has less weight than the original, but it doesn't mean it's good. It depends on what kind of derivative it is. If it was an abstract done by a highly skilled researcher, it's got very high weight. If it's an abstract done by somebody who was very careless, it's got low weight.
So if I'm following along correctly with what you've just said, it's important to keep in mind who created the record or provided the information within the record.
The who and the why is really important to us, especially when there's problems, there's conflicts. We have to think of who gave the information and why did they give it. This greatly influences the conclusion that we come to on that particular bit of information. As an example, the who, the informant. Was it, let's say on a birth record, was it the assessor of the 5th Civil District who gave the information, or was it the mother? We're going to put more weight into it if the mother gave the information than if the assessor gave the information. On the census, who gave the information? We can't determine that. So that has to influence us in believing that that census, if it doesn't jibe with other records is going to have lower weight. The who is very important. And the why is definitely important, because did the person give the information for, let us say, to settle property? Well, they were going to be pretty careful about that. They didn't want problems coming up over their property. Was it to settle a probate? They're likely to have given good information on that. Were they trying to establish a pension? Well, let us say that the widow had to have married her husband that served in the Revolutionary War before a certain date in 1794. That's one of the acts. And she was really married 2 months later. Well, you know, she might have fudged a couple of months there. Did somebody give information on getting a license to marry when they had really weren't of age, but they fibbed a little bit and they wanted to get that license? So the why, the who and the why is definitely helpful to us in determining the validity of the information. We take that all into account.
So can you continue on with your explanation of the primary and secondary characteristics of the information?
The second point, the information, again, this is a departure from earlier times. We used to say that records were primary or secondary. You say somebody would say, well, the death record is primary or this record was secondary. We no longer say that. We say that information is primary or secondary. And there's a very important reason for making that distinction, because most records that we look at are going to be a combination. If we really stop and we think about it, let's think about a death certificate. We have the name of the person. Well, that should be primary information, you would think. And then we have the date of death, likely primary information. But what about the date of the birth and the name of the father and the mother of the person who died?
So when you use the word primary in this context, what exactly does that mean?
Primary information itself refers to the quality of the information.
So how would I know a piece of primary information when I saw it?
It would be that information where the informant was somebody who was either at the event, somebody in a position to know. That would be primary information. That is why it's so important for us to identify the informant on any record. If we don't know the informant, there is no way we can determine whether or not it's primary information. And that's why even a census record, people will say, well, is that primary or secondary? Well, you know, we don't know who gave the information. So it doesn't mean it's not any good. That we have this tendency of thinking that, well, even when we go back to original and derivative, that the original's got to be good and the derivative not. That's not so. Same with primary and secondary. It doesn't mean that the secondary might not be good. It can be very good. The primary can have errors. Almost everybody has seen a birth record that's had an error. Information, primary or secondary, we have to realize that any of these can be incorrect. It doesn't mean that one is good and the other is bad. It's same with the original and derivative. So often people think, well, it's a derivative, it's not any good. That's not the case at all. Let us say the clerk's copy of the will into the will book is a good record. But if there's a problem and it doesn't jibe with other records, we have to consider it has less weight. A derivative has less weight than the original. We would go to the original and say, well, maybe the clerk made an error in copying one of the names into the will book. But as I was saying about the information, even a record like a birth record that we would say is primary information, I think we all know somebody who has seen a birth record that's got an error in it. So we have to judge these items as we collect them all, we compare them, we weigh each one, and then come to our conclusion.
So tell us about the two characteristics of the evidence itself.
Direct or indirect evidence. That seems to throw researchers as to what we mean there, direct or indirect. Well, if I look at a birth record and it says John Smith was born to William and Mary Smith on 1 April 1850. That's direct information. Otherwise, it says what it wants to say. I don't have to bring in another record to interpret that. It does not mean it's correct. There could be an error in that, but it is direct. But let us say I take that same record and I say now that unnamed son was born to this couple on 1 April 1850. Then I have to bring in another record to establish the name of that son. I might bring in a Bible or his later death record, an obituary, something else to determine the first name there. So now that's indirect information. But it doesn't mean it's wrong. I mean, my bringing in other information could have established a very accurate record. But that's the difference between the direct and indirect.
So the indirect evidence in the information within a source is definitely something that needs to be supported from other reliable sources.
Absolutely, you've got it. It needs to be supported with other records that might bear on that particular missing bit of information. So all of the information that we gather has to be subjected to these three steps: the source, the information, and the evidence. We get to the point where we just do it automatically. It's not a conscious effort on our part to do it.
Especially when you've been at it for a lot of years.
Well, you're right there.
Well, do you have a final thought that you'd like to share with our listeners?
If we try to think of our problem as a whole family, I think we can get overwhelmed very easily. If we look at it as all individual problems within that and approach each one of them, I think it's a much more satisfying research without the amount of frustration.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for sharing all your wonderful insights and your vast experience and knowledge.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome, Jim.
This concludes our interview with Christine Rose.